Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. I hope you all had a good, happy Mother's Day. Certainly happier Mother's Day than President Trump, who I think at last count tweeted about 124 times. Our guest today is Jonathan Karl, the chief White House correspondent for ABC News and the author of a new book, Front Row at the Trump Show. It's a hell of a show, Jonathan, isn't it?
It's really beyond our wildest imaginations.
Well, speaking of wildest imaginations, you've had a number of interesting exchanges with the president, and you've covered him since the beginning of the presidency. So you have a, shall we say, a complicated relationship with the president. But I want to play this and get a sense of what this was like. You're asking the president about, I believe it's an inspector general report from the Department of Health and Human Services, and this happened.
How long has that person been in government?
Did serve in the previous administration.
Oh, you didn't tell me that. Oh, I see. You didn't tell me that, John. You didn't tell me that. Did serve in the previous administration. You mean the Obama administration. Thank you for telling me that. See, there's a typical fake news deal.
You asked me when she was appointed. I told you when she was appointed.
You're a third-rate reporter, and what you just said is a disgrace, okay? You asked me, you said, sir, just got appointed. Take a look at what you said. Now I said, when did this person, how long in government? Well, it was appointed in the Obama administration. Thank you very much, John. Thank you very much. You will never make it. Go ahead.
John, give us a sense. You know, your front row at the Trump show. What is that like?
Well, first of all, that specific incident was so bizarre and so crazy because I was actually following up on a question that the president had posed to the Fox News reporter that was in there, who she had asked about the IG report, and the president said, "Well, who is the IG? What's his name?" And you know, he went around, and then I raised my hand. She didn't have the name in front. I said, "Look, it was Christy Grimm. Well, when was she appointed?" And I said, "Well, appointed by your administration in, you know, January of this year." And the president was momentarily kind of like silenced by that, because his talking point was this was an Obama person. And the briefing went on for some time. And then you could see him. He's still, the gears are still turning, and he comes back out back to the podium after Pence and the others have been out there for a little bit, and points to me again. "Well, how long has she been in government?" And I said, "Well, you know, she served in the previous administration." And that's when he did that whole bit. It's bizarre. I mean, it's not the first, second, or third time that he's lashed out at me at an event like this, you know, at a press conference, or he's done it to me in the Oval Office, at the pool sprays. It's an odd experience. But the most frustrating thing about it is, you know why he's doing it. Mm-hmm. He's doing it to try to prevent answering whatever question is being put forth, and also to make it part of the show. I mean, he wants to vilify us, so the media is the villain. He's a WWE guy. He loves professional wrestling. You need the heel. The press is the heel. This is all part of the show.
Okay, I was going to get to that. Basically, you have the front row at the show, but you are the show itself, because he, of course, is the executive producer of the show, and he loves to have this WWE exchange with the journalists. So knowing that, I assume that everybody in the press room understands that this is a form of sort of performance theater for the president. Now, that's a special challenge, isn't it? I mean, that's got to make it hard, knowing that he wants to make you part of the show, and he loves doing that.
It is. Somewhere along the line, and it happened during the campaign, he realized that the press is a better target for him, a better mm-hmm. villain than the Democrats. I mean, the applause lines at his rallies are bigger when he goes after the press. It also has the beneficial side effect of creating the impression that the press is just the opposition party, and therefore you don't really need to take seriously what they report, because they're the opposition party. It's like a DNC press release, and the front page of the New York Times, no difference. And so it's very convenient, but it's difficult for us, because, or you know, for a reporter who goes in there every day trying to be a reporter, trying to, you know, get at the truth, hold officials accountable, report in a, to borrow an old phrase, in a fair and balanced way. When you have the person you're covering try to make you part of the story.
Now, there aren't.
I don't want to be the story. Right. But, I mean,
But some of your colleagues do want to be part of the story. So let me push back. I mean, you know, there are people who will say that recognizing that it is the show, that there is criticism that there are members of the media who are also grandstanding, that the these events have not become simply getting answers from the president, but they've become performance art by the media. You see that?
Yeah, I do. And there is a one thing that fuels that, of course, like it fuels so much, is Twitter. So you get immediate feedback when you are in there, and if somebody comes up and really puts it to the president, you know, the tweet about it goes viral, and it creates this really perverse incentive system. So yes, you do have people, but look, you've had reporters grandstanding for as long as there have been reporters, and especially as long as there have been reporters and television cameras. I mean, my good friend Sam Donaldson,
we all remember that.
You create a persona, you do that. So there's certain, that has always been there. It is still there. Some people have accused me of that. I honestly tell you that I go in there, I'm trying to get at the story, and that's what matters to me. But when he attacks a reporter, some people like to go back and just hit back at him and say, how can you attack my news organization? You've just attacked my news organization. You need to call on me, Mr. President. You know, I mean, it's like, come on, who cares? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if he calls me a third-rate reporter. That doesn't matter. What matters is the issue I was asking about, which is an HHS report that showed that a survey of more than 300 hospitals found that there were chronic problems with testing, that they couldn't get test results back in a timely manner. That's what matters, not the, oh my God, he called him a third-rate reporter. Who cares?
You know, it's occurred to me in the past, and you've been around a long time, and you've watched all of this unfold, but to a certain extent, I'll throw it out and you react to it, that Donald Trump is a figure who's, in effect, almost broken journalism, because up until recently, journalism really wasn't, the mores and the norms of journalism really weren't set up to account for somebody who would lie so frequently, who would throw so much stuff at you, who would, in fact, deflect this much. And so whether it's the cable television networks that can't decide whether or not to give him free airtime, or whether or not it's reporters who are just trying to figure out, the president told 26 lies, how do I come up with a 3-minute report out of this? This is a unique challenge for journalism right now. How well do you think the media has responded to that? And by the way, you can push back against my notion that he's kind of broken journalism as well. Feel free to.
I think he's certainly, it's bending. Look, the problem is that he, with the habitual telling of untruths, with the outrageous behavior, with the attacks on journalism itself, with the attacks on the idea of a free press, he puts us into a position of constantly fact-checking, calling out the lies, pushing back against the outrageous behavior. And then we end up acting exactly as he wants us to act, which is as the opposition party. So if you're out there, tuning in, you see this battle. It's a battle between the president and the press. And the press, there's always lots to criticize about the press. It's always there. But now, over the past 3.5 years, if you tune into two of the three cable news channels, you see the outrage of the day, the outrage of the minute. It's nonstop outrage. Look at what he did now. Look at what he said now. Look what he tweeted now. And we can't even kind of distinguish between the colossal scandal and the trivial scandal.
It flattens everything.
It's all a big scandal. I mean, I talk in the book about, and you know, about the dust up over Hurricane Dorian and how he said it was going to hit Alabama, and the National Weather Service, you know, corrected him and Sharp. And I've got a great story in there that had never been told about, you know, I was the first person to mention that on network television. I put it in my report on Labor Day, this past Labor Day. And, you know, it wasn't a huge scandal. I just mentioned it. And it was like, it was at the end of my report. It was like, by the way, he said it was going to Alabama, and the National Weather Service said, no, it's not. I mean, who cares? It's a minor thing. But that was the beginning of a week that culminated in him breaking out the Sharpie and writing on the National Weather Service or FEMA's map, you know, showing that the cone actually, look, if you go over here, it includes Alabama. But he called me into the Oval Office to complain about that report. On Tuesday, right, the day after Labor Day. And first of all, I was amazed that he watched it, because it was like a minor thing. It was like, and then he spent 45 minutes of his day meeting with me the next day in the Oval Office about my, what he called, bullshit hurricane story. And
45 minutes.
We talked about other things as well, but it was 45 minutes. And get it, the context is, this is not long after the shootings in El Paso and Dayton. Overnight, Monday into Tuesday, North Korea had done, you know, test fired some missiles, and you know, a hurricane was bearing down on Florida. It hadn't hit yet, and he's taking time to talk about whether or not I mentioned this. I mean, it's mind blowing. But the way that story was covered over the following week, you know, you would have thought that we had just invaded Iraq again, you know, and that there weren't weapons of mass destruction. I mean, it was like, you know, oh my God, look at what he did. I mean, he's bullying the weather service. He's saying things that aren't true. He's getting, you know, he's breaking out the Sharpie. Oh, look at, and you know, at the end of the day, how major a story was it? I mean,
right.
You know, I mean, I
guess when you flatten everything out, if everything is a five alarm fire, nothing's a five alarm fire.
Exactly.
So on your book, it says at the very, on the book flap, I have actual quotes from the book because I've read it. This book is possible because of the unique relationship of Donald Trump has had with Jonathan Karl, a reporter he has praised, fought, and branded an enemy of the people. So what is your unique relationship with Donald Trump? Because we all think we see the show, but you see the show from a different perspective. So what is your unique relationship?
Yeah, I've got some of the backstage access. First of all, I first met him in 1994. I was a reporter for the New York Post, and I was an aspiring political reporter, and I had, you know, been at the paper for just about 5 or 6 months, and I was had worked my way to be like the number three guy at City Hall for the number three or four newspaper in New York. You know, I mean, I was just trying to, like, you know, do my thing and report on politics. Giuliani had just been elected mayor. And there was a story that I didn't really care about, but was completely dominating certainly the New York Post newsroom, but also New York. Michael Jackson had just gotten married to Lisa Marie Presley. So you have the biggest pop star on the planet getting married to, you know, Elvis Presley's daughter. And they were staying at Trump Tower. And they hadn't been seen in public yet. So there was a huge crush of paparazzi and camera crew. You know,
there's a lot going on there.
So on a whim, I had nothing to do because nobody cared what was happening at City Hall with all that going on Fifth Avenue. So I placed a call as just a total whim to the general number at the Trump Organization. I'd never met Donald Trump. I asked for Donald Trump. And I got his gatekeeper, his secretary, Norma Federer, and said, what do you want to talk to him about? It's like, well, I want to pitch him on a story. I want to do a story about why the most famous newlyweds on the planet want to start their honeymoon at Trump Tower. And I figured somehow that this might be the kind of thing that he would like. And sure enough, within an hour, I got a call back and an invite to come immediately to Trump Tower. And there began a relationship 26 years ago. He showed me all around. He showed me where they were staying, introduced me to Michael's bodyguards, showed me the tunnels underneath where they got in and out without being spotted by the cameras outside. Told me everything about Trump Tower, like, this is where Sophia Loren lives, this is where the British royal family has an apartment, this is, Andrew Lloyd Webber, Steven Spielberg, and showed me, and we published in the Post four pages of articles on this, including, of course, the cover.
Ah, so. So you became a favorite.
Yeah. So, but, and then when he started running for president, well, not running for, I did the first interview with him of the 2016 cycle, which is another crazy, crazy story. It was in August of 2013. So it's 2 years before he comes down the escalator. And it was out, he was out at Bob Vanderplatz, you know, at his annual, meeting. This is the evangelicals out in Iowa. You know, Vanderplatz had endorsed, Huckabee, had endorsed, Santorum. So he endorsed the last two winners of the Iowa caucuses. And here Donald Trump was coming in, to speak to them. And I thought it was kind of funny to see this guy, you know, three marriages, the personal life, all of him was going to come and speak to some Iowa evangelicals. I didn't think he was going to run for president, mind you, but I thought this was kind of an interesting thing. So I went out and did an interview with him out there. Ted Cruz, by the way, was also speaking that day. And Ted Cruz spoke before Trump. And when Cruz left, a bunch of reporters who were covering it all went to flock to Cruz because everybody assumed Cruz was going to be the, you know, was the guy to watch at that point. So actually a lot of the reporters didn't even stick around for Trump's speech, you know? And then I interviewed him backstage, and anyway, so I, and by the way, that interview, which was about 25 minutes worth of interview, we only aired about 5 minutes of it because, you know, I mean, come on, it's Donald Trump. I mean, you know, and he's not going to run, and you know, why would you care? So we aired like 5 minutes of it at the back of the, so I've gone back and like looked at some of the, all the stuff that was on the cutting room floor, and it's just nuts. But the bottom line is, he knows me. I'm a familiar face to him. He seems to have this kind of love-hate relationship. He'll try to court me, like, you know, he just praised my book at the White House on Friday, which was just a really something I didn't
expect. So between that I was going to ask you about that. So he rips you as a third-rate reporter who will never make it, and then he praises your book. Did you have a conversation with him between there where he like puts his hand on your shoulder and says, "Ah, John, I didn't mean it. That was just for show. I'm so sorry if I hurt your feelings."
Yeah, Trump saying I'm sorry. That would be good.
That would be a scoop.
Yeah, that would be a scoop. No, but he does it in public. I think that effectively is what he was doing with, you know, with the bit about the book. It's interesting. I had two separate conversations in the like 10 days before this with Republicans who reached out to me because they had met Trump. One was a Republican congressman who had met Trump with a group of Freedom Caucus guys, you know, like I said, almost 2 weeks ago at the White House. And he called me afterwards and said, "Your book was on the Resolute." I was like, "Oh, interesting. My book was on Trump's guest." And then I got a call from another Republican congressman a week later saying that they had lunch with Trump and my book was there with him in his, you know, that room off the Oval Office where he has lunch and watches television. So I knew that the book was in his orbit. I didn't, you know, I mean, who knows? I mean, it's got nice pictures in the middle. I don't know.
Well, he likes the fact that you recognize that it was a show. Okay, so I'm dying to ask this question since you've known him for so long. You know, every once in a while, I will go back and I will look at one of the old clips, you know, from the 1980s, early 1990s, of him talking. And so I'll ask you this question. Has he changed in any fundamental way? Do you notice any difference in the way he communicates? Is the guy that you met back in 1994 the same? Is the guy sitting in the Oval Office right now? Assuming he's in the Oval Office.
I don't think he has. I don't think he's changed. And by the way, I don't think he's quite at the Oval Office yet, but he'll be there. I honestly think that he has changed almost not at all. When I first met him in 1994 at Trump Tower, he asked me in the middle of our walking around, showing me, and you know, I had my notepad out and I was writing my story. He said, "Do you want to take a picture?" I was like, "What do you mean?" And of course, he meant take a picture with him, which I did not. I mean, I was a reporter on a story. You don't usually have the subject say, "Hey, let's pose for a shot." So So I have this photograph, which was in a box in my basement for, you know, more than a couple decades. I pulled out when he became president. I was like, "I wonder if I still have that photo. Where is that photo?" Because I remembered it very well. And I looked at it, and he looks almost exactly the same dark suit. This one back then was a couple sizes smaller than it is now, but same suit, same red tie that is a little too long. The hair hasn't really changed all that much. And the way he talked to me then and the way he talks to me now, I'm telling you, it is remarkably consistent. When I sat in the Oval Office the day after Labor Day talking about my hurricane story, I had this flashback to 1994 in Trump Tower and just thinking, God, everything is the same, except now he is sitting behind the desk that Reagan and Kennedy and so many others sat at, and he's got, the stakes are entirely different. His surroundings are entirely different, but the guy is exactly the same.
So let's talk about the show right now, because he clearly is trying to change the show. He had thought that the way to deal with the coronavirus pandemic was to hold those daily briefings, and that was the Trump show, and he thought that was getting great ratings. It didn't work out that well. So we no longer have the coronavirus briefings. He's brought back the daily White House briefings. So to talk to me a little bit about the way that he wants to change the show from focusing on the pandemic to the transition to greatness, the great comeback story. I mean, isn't this the next version, the next season of the Trump show?
It is. And the way he measures success is the way he's being portrayed in the news media, which is really quite something for a guy that so vilifies the news media constantly. And he does this explicitly. He's, in some ways he's the most transparent president we've ever had. So he's obviously talked about the great ratings for his coronavirus press conferences, which was really an odd thing. And his new press secretary closed her very first briefing by teasing the upcoming town hall with Bret Baier at the Lincoln Memorial, and saying it's going to be great, just like the highly rated coronavirus press briefings, which was really something else to hear from the press secretary on her first day. But if you listen to him, he constantly talks about the great reviews he's getting, the great reviews. For all the things, for the testing, for the this, for that. I mean, I don't know where he's reading these reviews, but that's how he sees it. He wants, it's like, it really, I don't want to belabor the analogy, but it is exactly what it is. It's like you've got your Broadway debut. What do the critics say? What are the reviews? That's what he cares about. So that's why he does. I mean, part of it with the press is this, we are part of the show, but part of it really does drive him nuts when he is criticized over this stuff.
Really?
It really gets at him. He really thinks that he's doing this, that if he's, first of all, if he says it enough, if he says he's doing a great job and the wonderful job his administration is doing, then it becomes true. It's kind of like, it's kind of like one of those promotional videos for you're selling condos in a new
building.
Well,
that's right. I mean, he really does think if he comes up with the right slogan, if he says it enough, if he sells these things. So is this pandemic different? Is this the one storyline that he cannot control, that he just can't spin away? I mean, it is reality versus spin. And do you think that – now, look, we've done this for the last 4 years. Like, well, this is the turning point. Well, this is the breaking point, and nothing turns out to be. So is this different?
Well,
it feels different.
Yeah, it sure does. But have you seen the 1 minute ad that they put out the other day?
I did.
Touting his, it's a really effective ad, I think. I mean, if you know nothing of what's going on, if that is what you know, I mean, it makes it sound like it is firm, decisive leadership from the start, sprinkled in there praise from people like Andrew Cuomo. You think, oh my God, he's really in charge. Look at him. He's playing the part. He's doing it. But this is different than any opponent that he's ever faced. Obviously, he can't bully the virus. He can't change perception only goes so far. There are facts here that have touched everybody's lives, not just those who have been exposed to the virus or know somebody who've been exposed to the virus, who have, friends or relatives who have gotten terribly sick or who have died. But it's also everybody in America is affected by the you know, what's happened here. Everybody has kids who are home because the schools are closed, or you know, are home themselves because they can't go to work. I mean, this affects everybody.
Right. Anyway, so you have to sit there with the front row. This is not a trick question, by the way, but why did you write this book? My theory is that, given sort of the kaleidoscopic weirdness of that experience, were you trying to make sense of what you were experiencing and seeing, trying to put some coherence on what otherwise would be one news cycle cycling after another?
That is exactly what drove me to write this book. I have been living through this insane period. I mean insane just in terms of the tonnage of news. It's exhausting. I've kept detailed notes, and I've been there for all of this, but it's like every day it's, you know, I'm out there reporting on what's happening, and then we're on to the next crazy thing, the next thing. And I wanted to be able to take a step back and try to figure out, what does it all mean? How did this happen? And, you know, I don't know if I quite got the answer to that. But what I realized is it's an amazing story. And what I tried to do is tell the story without being overly judgmental about, you know, I mean, I wanted to kind of document what this has been like, because I've had this unique relationship with him. This is a president unlike any we've ever seen, and, you know, probably ever will see. And I've had this very unusual vantage point because of my relationship with him. So I wanted to write a story that basically anybody would get something out of, including his staunchest critics and people that like him. I mean, look, there's a lot in here. I mean, I document all the untruths, all the manipulation of the truth, the war on truth, which is what I call it in the end. But I tell the story of this improbable rise, what I saw, my interactions with him. And I wanted to write a book that if 20 or 40 years from now you came down into the United States and you just asked the question, what the hell was that thing all about, that Trump thing? That somebody would say, read this, you'll get a sense. This explains what that was like, what it was all about.
The book is Front Row at the Trump Show. Jonathan Karl, Chief White House Correspondent for ABC News, and I really appreciate it. And Jonathan, for our listeners, you and I go back. I actually was doing the math, 28 years, because you actually wrote the review of one of my books, A Nation of Victims, and I was always very grateful. You wrote that for the Wall Street Journal, right? Do I remember that correctly?
I wrote it for the Wall Street Journal. It was my very first article for the Wall Street Journal. I ended up writing, you know, I've written dozens and dozens of reviews for them over the years. That was the very first one. And I loved the book. I loved that book. Well, I thought it was great. So,
well, among the many shocks that I've experienced having written a book about victims is watching how Donald Trump and the conservative movement have adopted victimhood themselves, that they've decided that this is going to be a powerful political weapon. But that is for a different conversation. Yes. So, Jonathan, I don't think I've ever thanked you for the review from 1992. So I'll take this occasion. And again, thank you for this book, Front Row at the Trump Show. And thanks for coming on the Bulwark podcast today.
Great. Thank you, Charlie.
Special thanks to Jonathan Karl. I appreciated that very much. Special bonus today. We had some weekend content at the Bulwark, and I put out a special Sunday newsletter. And one of the articles that we featured in that newsletter was by Ward Carroll, who flew F-14 Tomcats for 15 years after graduating from the Naval Academy. And he was named the Naval Institute Press Author of the Year in 2001. For his debut novel, Punk's War. And he's also the editor of Approach, which is the Navy's aviation safety magazine. And he made his debut in The Bulwark by writing a piece about what it is about Donald Trump that should we say, annoys him? He uses a stronger word. Ward Carroll joins me on the Bulwark Podcast. Good to talk with you, Ward.
Hi, Charlie. How are you?
Good. And as I was telling you before we started doing this, I got a very good response from newsletter readers about this piece. It's in the Bulwark. I like people. The headline is, I like people who were captured. Donald Trump, not so much. Everyone has a personal reason to despise Trump. This is mine. So let's talk about your piece and why you decided to write it now.
So Whitey Feitner was a World War II ace who recently passed away in early April. And I was working on a piece about him. I went back to a bound edition of Approach that I have from my time as the editor, which was late 80s, early 90s. I was a lieutenant, and that was my first shore duty. I'd just come out, like I say in the piece, I'd just come off my first sea tour in my first fighter squadron. And I had the gift of being able to be kind of the poet warrior because I was flying over at the air base in Virginia Beach. And then also when I wasn't flying, I was taking care of this magazine. So this article with Whitey Feitner, I was looking at that issue. And in that issue was also the interview with Jim Stockdale. And I had not read that for some years. And I was just, as the excerpt in the piece in the Bulwark, anybody who reads it gets, these are just amazing guys, right? And it just hit me that my pedigree and my heritage is very much married to these POWs. So yeah.
Remind our listeners who James Stockdale was, you know, that he was a Medal of Honor recipient who had been the senior ranking POW in the Hanoi Hilton and then really took the worst of it from his captors. Some people may remember Stockdale from his vice presidential run with Ross Perot, but he was quite a figure in the American military.
And it's a shame that, and that understates it, that people remember him as Ross Perot's VP in that sort of ill-fated debate, mm-hmm. And how his performance there, you know, he didn't make, as Dennis Miller says, he has the crime of not being good television. But let's go back. He was the air wing commander aboard an aircraft carrier at the outset of the Vietnam War. So he was on that first strike that actually was not the imminent threat that the Johnson administration presented that it was. And so he was actually a huge critic of the war because he was part of that big lie from the outset. And he was very candid about that. Not so much at the time, but in the later years. So he was the air wing commander, shot down over Hanoi, thereby became the senior POW. And as the senior ranking officer, as you've said, and as we say in the article, he took the worst of it, right? So they tried to make him the star of this propaganda film that the East Germans produced for the North Vietnamese. And he refused to the point of smashing his own face in. So he couldn't be on screen. And he was later bestowed the Medal of Honor because of his courage and his leadership and just a tough guy. So I had a chance to meet him on a number of occasions and a couple of times face-to-face, or actually it was a phoner for this article. And then later face-to-face at actually the Tailhook Convention in 1990, I took him up to the infamous third floor. Now, 90 was not the bad year. The bad year was 91, but never mind that. Tailhook is a fantastic association of which I've been a lifelong member. So he was there, and I took him around and you know, went to the Top Gun suite, went to the various. So here's Jim Stockdale talking to the boys about the good old days, and it was amazing, right? So he was as he did not like to be known solely as a prisoner of war. He liked to be known as a guy who was a test pilot in the early jet era and a guy who did his duty in combat. And then the other thing that was amazing as I talked to him, you realize that in his time in captivity, he blossomed into a philosopher, not just an aviator who was in captivity, but a philosopher. So he had studied in grad school Epictetus and Stoicism. And that became the thing, more so than the jingoistic, you know, apple pie and Chevrolet. His feelings towards Stoicism is what he accredits for him being able to survive his captivity. So an amazing, amazing American.
No, and I was really struck by that. I don't know that I'd said that, read that before about the writings of Epictetus and the way that Stoicism really was the way that you get through it. I think we could all use a little bit of Epictetus these days. You know, there are a lot of good books on Stoicism, which I would perhaps suggest that people going through what we're going through now might turn to. But what we're going through now is nothing compared to what these POWs went through. So fast forward to John McCain and Donald Trump, because you develop this really deep appreciation for these men and for their courage and their sacrifices.
So I had seen John McCain in passing. In fact, he was still a captain in the Navy the first time I saw him at a distance in Annapolis. Met him in an Army-Navy game, but never had any face-to-face. In fact, a classmate of mine was his military legislative assistant for years and years, a guy named Chris Paul. Highly respected, obviously, as a warfighter in my circles, in my tribe of naval aviation, carrier-based naval aviation. Also kind of a folklore, folk hero, because he was really a not a model mid, let's put it that way. Kind of a guy who was willing to break the rules in pursuit of his appetites, you know. And so that mids like guys who get away with breaking the rules, and especially guys who go on to greatness, because the machine would like to tell you if you don't put your nose to the grindstone, you're going to be a failure. And you look at McCain, you're like, well, he's doing pretty good. So why don't you guys lay off, right? So he was on my podcast when I was the editor of military.com. I had a podcast called From the Editor's Desk. And this is when, during the 08 campaign, and he was actually walking down the street on Capitol Hill on a cell phone when we did this podcast. And basically he was trying out his planks that he actually did on the debate stage that night. And so it was a really cool, candid conversation. And he was, you know, he was very contrite, and it didn't seem to be about him so much. And I just always, I liked his tone. And so I saw him face to face in my role as a digital editor periodically. Past that time, obviously, as I say in the piece, I didn't like the Sarah Palin piece or that choice. And I was very close to the post 9/11 GI Bill, because we were advising the Obama administration, military.com, my benefits guy, was advising the VA and the Obama administration on the unintended consequences of that legislation. And all we were hearing from McCain is it's not funded. And so they just wanted to spike it. So, you know, we didn't like that, because we knew this was going to be a great benefit for those who were fighting the current wars. And then the last time I saw him was on the rooftop of, I don't know exactly which building it was, but he gave a little speech, and he and I went sidebar, and we were actually just talking about, you know, flying jets. It was really cool. I have a bunch of pictures from that too, that I you know, appreciate. I was able to get that close range to him and have that conversation towards the end of his life.
You know, I know that a lot of people do know the story, but it is worth reminding people about exactly what John McCain went through in Vietnam when he was shot down over Hanoi. As you write, he broke both arms and a leg during the ejection from his jet. He was pulled out of the lake that he'd parachuted in, beaten, refused medical treatment. The North, of course, his father was a four-star admiral, and the Vietnamese offered him early release as a show of good faith or for propaganda points. And this is an amazing story that John McCain refused that. He refused freedom, and his torture intensified, and he wasn't repatriated for another 5 years along with the rest of the American POWs. And I think your point is, look, you can disagree with this guy about politics. You can have all kinds of opinions, but that is an amazing story of heroism.
Yeah, we all know guys who check the block in the political sphere. Yeah, I was in the Navy, or I was in the military, you know, some jag in the rear with the gear kind of a thing. This guy did it right. You know, he was a frontline operator, a carrier aviator, and went into harm's way a bunch of missions. And then, as you've just recounted, when given the chance to come home, he refused. And he was in for another 5 years. So, right. So that lives in sort of a sarcophagus of greatness and honor. And so this is sort of the segue into the Donald Trump statement. Which when I heard it, I was like, okay, that's the end of his campaign. Yeah,
I like people that weren't captured and he denied that he was a hero.
Yeah. So at that point, I'm like, whoa, you can say some wacky stuff there, you know, Mr. Trump, but now it's personal, as I said. Now, hold it. That thing is not in play. And so, you know, he was called on it by pundits and I know Steve Hayes went sidebar with him and right. kind of in the basement of that, you know, kind of said, can you say that again, sir? Are you serious? You know, he was talking in circles down there. And I think in time, as Donald Trump is uniquely capable of, he sort of tried to walk it back or sort of said, I never really said that, or I think he is a hero. And then he said, hey, I gave him the airplane. And so, you know, all's forgiven, right? To the McCain family after he passed away.
No.
You know, all of that stuff. So, but once you say that, it's out there. And that, to me, shows his deepest lack of character in a very personal way.
Okay, so this is the hard part, because, I mean, I remember this very well. I remember talking to Steve Hayes about this, and his reaction was the same of a lot of people, as yours as well, was that this is the end of the campaign for Donald Trump. But, of course, we've said that so many times that, you know, how do you question John McCain's heroism? It was so petty, the contrast with his own lack of military experience. And over the years, of course, his lack of understanding and appreciation of the military values has become so apparent. So this is the question I have to ask you, though, is like, why do so many people in the military, so many veterans, still support Donald Trump? Why did they not have the reaction that we had? Why was that not the end of his campaign?
That's a fantastic question, Charlie. That's why I'm not on Facebook. My own classmates stand in defense of him. That's why I didn't post that article on my Facebook page.
Really?
I did something for the Dispatch a few, like last month when the Mowdley, Crozier, Teddy Roosevelt thing yeah. happened. Just, you know, as an awareness vehicle, put it on my Facebook page. And the resultant food fight was so disgusting between guys who graduated from the Naval Academy when I did. Now, you know, if I went infinitum through their pedigrees, I will tell you none of them are naval aviators. Many of them got out as soon as their commitment was over and now are realtors in Texas or, you know, created tech firms or have small business owners that like the reduction in regulations and payroll taxes and dot, dot, dot. Those kinds of things. So I guess my short answer to how can people in the military support him is I think because the military is made up of a lot of different Americans in a diverse group, everybody comes to this problem in their own way. But I will tell you mm-hmm. to be semi-elitist about it is the intelligentsia in the officer corps and the senior enlisted corps have never bought it and do not buy it now. Now, those on active duty cannot say as much, but I will also say, as you heard from people when you pushed the newsletter yesterday, I've heard from people, you know, thanks for saying what I can't. Probably half a dozen unsolicited inputs from folks around the fleet, including those one guy particularly on the Teddy Roosevelt right now. I don't know. It does. I want to go one-on-one when I see those attitudes and go, okay, so let's sit down. You tell me now
yeah.
how you think this guy in any way represents what you would want in a leader. If Donald Trump gave you an order, would you carry it out? If he was your wingman, would you do what he said? You know, all of these sort of just the basics, the tenets of the military life and military character, he's anathema in every way. So I don't know, but you're right. There is a large segment, primarily whatever the military equivalent of the blue collar segment is. Are big supporters, and I don't know why.
As you point out, you know, his conduct and his character would never be tolerated in the officer corps. He would never be given command, and the enlisted people would not trust him and respect him if he behaved the way that he behaved. And the contrast, I thought, between him and Captain Crozier was so dramatic in so many ways. So, first of all, what was your take on Captain Crozier, and do you think he will ever return to command?
I'll answer the second one, sure. which is no.
Hmm.
And the reason I say that, because there was a glimmer when the chief of naval operations said, I think he's eligible to return to command, right? And then the Secretary of Defense wrestled that away from him. And so at that point, it's like, okay, now Esper is more Trump-facing than CNO. And as a function of that, I think, to answer your question, is he will not return to command. He certainly won't return to command of the Teddy Roosevelt. And I don't think he'll get another carrier because the pipeline is sort of, you know, mm-hmm. is chugging along. And if you were to inject him in there, somebody else gets booted. And so I don't think so. Now, will he make flag rank? You know, because generally carrier CEOs, about 80% of them make admiral. It's a desirable pipeline and they, you know, go through a huge test. It's a long pipeline and you got to be smart and you got to be a good leader. So that's TBD, whether he'll make flag. But I don't think he'll go back to the Teddy Roosevelt. Now, my feelings about that circumstance.
Yes.
So I know former acting secretary Moseley pretty well. Mm. I think he was the right guy for the job when he came in November. He got right to trying to create a 355 ship plan for Donald Trump and the pundits who were jumping up and down about there, like Hugh Hewitt and people like that, mm-hmm. like, hey, Navy, you guys are slow rolling the president. And so he was focused on no nonsense. Remember, his predecessor, Richard Spencer, got cross-threaded on the Gallagher situation,
correct,
trying to work a drug deal with the White House, and Esper didn't like that so much. So Moseley's like, okay, no drama, focus, good to go. And he had the right sort of Renaissance background, procurement, helicopter pilot, very much understood the budget cycles and so forth. So he was the right guy. And I saw him speak at a number of keynotes, just articulate, great, conversational. I talked to him on the sidelines of the Army-Navy game this year, which Trump was at, by the way. That's a whole nother thing. But and he's conversant. And I thought, wow, what a genuinely good guy, right? And so I think his beef with Crozier when it first arises is he jumped the chain of command. Right. It's like, look, we're moving earth and sky to give you everything you need, Captain. And now you leak this to, well, didn't directly, but it gets in the hands of the San Francisco Chronicle. And so now you enjoy no top cover. In fact, I'm so tweaked that I'm going to remove you from command because your willingness or your capacity to do this shows me that you don't have the character to be in charge of a nuclear powered aircraft carrier. Right. So at that point, it just comes down to, okay, we need the investigation, which was launched, to show us the TikTok, if you will, of the message traffic. Who talked to whom when, right? And so did everybody move earth and sky? I happen to be good friends with the fleet commander and the Indo-PACOM commander as well. And I know those guys, if they're, you know, if you put a problem at their feet, they're going to work to solve it, right? So I don't know, and it still hasn't come out because Esper is now slow rolling that investigation. Yeah, yeah. So, but what was unforgivable is Moseley taking that, you know, 8-hour flight at, what was it, $23,000 of tax? Yeah. No, $230,000 of taxpayer money to go and yell at the crew, you know? And so we've all seen the transcript. In fact, I got it very early, you know, proprietary sources. That's why I was, I tweeted it first, I think, of anybody that day, that crazy Monday that we all had. And so at that point, it's like, oh my gosh, this is unforgivable. You know, I mean, whatever high ground you had, you've just ceded. So at that, after that all fell out, you know, here next day, Moseley resigns / is fired. You know, the Crozier is on Guam with coronavirus and the guy who was the CEO comes back to take over. And so I'm willing to wait and see what the investigation finds. And I was thinking that maybe Crozier was in the right and he was not getting, to his satisfaction, the response that he needed. At that point, if your sailor's health is in jeopardy, I think he seriously thought it was, you'll do whatever you got to do. Like a good parent, you'll do whatever you got to do to take care of your charges. And so I was withholding judgment. And so I still hear both sides, you know, I'm waiting for this investigation to come out in its definitive form to see who was quote unquote right.
And the other aspect of this, of course, is the message that it sends to other members of command,
whether or not they will get in trouble or damage their careers if they are too outspoken about the threat that they perceive for the men under their command, the men and women under their command, because this thing is not done. It's not over. The military has unique social distancing issues. And so the question is, will other captains, will other majors, will other colonels not speak out because they see what happens? And is that a legitimate concern?
That's a brilliant point, Charlie. That's the penultimate point, is that we wrestled with that very problem in the summer of 2017. You remember the McCain and the Fitzgerald had collisions,
right?
17 sailors killed, peacetime cruising. It's like, this is as basic as it gets. Sailing ships, don't hit other ships. Come on, you know. And so what came out of that those investigations, actually that investigation was led by Phil Davidson, who's now Indo-PACOM there, the four-star in the Pacific Theater. What he found was a hesitance to sing out when the ship was either had training issues or mechanical failures or manning. And the takeaway was, hey guys, you know, we're white hat here. No penalties if you tee up the fact that you're not ready to put to sea. But, you know, to your point, COs look at what happens to others that do that and how punitive it is. And you take a bunch of steps back away from this idea that we want to hear what your problems are so we can help you, Captain. And so we're dealing with that right now. There is a crisis of leadership that's working in parallel to all of everything else that's going on. And now you layer on COVID-19, and these are challenging times for morale fleet-wide.
Ward Carroll, thank you so much for joining me. The piece is up at the Bulwark. I like people who were captured. Donald Trump, not so much. Everyone has a personal reason to despise Trump. This is mine by Ward Carroll. Thank you for spending time with us on the podcast this morning.
My pleasure, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.